final word is delegated to the chosen few. It has long been pointed out that to hold an election every few years is not only a highly imprecise way of expressing the voter's wishes, because on these rare election days he has to consider a large number of issues, and his chosen representative will in fact not represent him on several of them, but it is also notably loose-wristed, because the voter has little control over his representatives between elections. In a world where politicians act only on the instructions of instantaneous public polls, we are perhaps moving toward a form of true citizens' government. It is not difficult to imagine a future in which voters sitting at home will be able to organize referendums, educate themselves in exhaustive detail about the pros and cons of issues, and register their votes. Will this necessarily produce a political utopia? Maybe not. It is possible to envisage a society so dominated by special interest groups that the views and votes of all the people are not in fact readily accepted. We may not like or adapt well to fully participative democracy. We could discover unappreciated advantages in our present form of slow-moving, deliberative, insufficiently representative democracy. We might find that in its inertia, for example, there is more than a measure of stability. A popular theme in news media and science fiction today stems from the fear of an atomized, disconnected society, masses of isolated people broadcasting anonymous opinions from the mouths of avatars with strange pseudonyms. I am not surprised that real-time technologies are fomenting anxiety of this sort. However, I see them doing far more good for society than did the quintessential 20th century technologies, which were in retrospect highly dehumanizing. From sweatshops to HAL-like mainframe computers and atomic weapons, the technologies of the 20th century brought in their wake the fear and reality of suppression, repression, and annihilation. The technologies of the next century, as far as we can tell, present the opportunity for more individual freedom and control. Although the information revolution will present its own problems, the construction of an iron information curtain is unlikely. Who needs vision? Some business people have no patience for this sort of wide-angled gazing at the big picture. What they want to know has any of it got to do with the price of eggs? The proximate effects on business of merging computers and communications are no less remarkable for being familiar. Yet they are its least significant consequence for organizations striving to incorporate the perspectives of real-time thinking into management. To be sure, linked computers control and automate manufacturing, speed the design of packaging, minimize inventories, assist automatic scheduling and distribution, and track barcodes on products at every stage in the pipeline. But the clue to computerization's most profound consequence for the business environment lies in the estimated 50,000 new products designed, simulated, and tested with the aid of computers that are announced every year in America, up from only a few thousand annually in 1970. These new products have sprung from a meshing of technological and social vectors that is profoundly altering the psychology of markets. In the new reforming marketplace, just as in those countries and regions that now hold regular political referendums, choice has itself become a paramount value. Business has come a long way from Henry Ford's assembly line stamping out a one-size-fits-all Model T. Consider a common domestic chore, buying food. As the product count in the average supermarket has risen from a few thousand in 1950 to 10,000 in 1980 to more than 30,000 today, the number of cereal brands that see at least $1 million in annual revenues has grown from 84 in 1979 to more than 150 today. There are 1,000 brands of mustard, hundreds of different shapes and kinds of cookies, entire walls lined with cosmetics and dairy products, and more than 100 brands of lipstick. The grocery store near my home recently added to its beverage aisle a section for beers from microbreweries. I counted 33 different labels, most of which I didn't recognize. The computers, scanners, databases, and networks of information technology have turned the grocery store into an international food bazaar. 20 years ago, a mainstream grocery store could not have accommodated the handful of customers who preferred pita bread to Ritz crackers. On grocery shelves today are such exotica, or what used to be exotica, as sake, lemongrass, coconut milk, several brands of black bean and soy sauce, basmati rice, tamarind pods, bok choy, French sea salt, morels, polenta, mangoes, lavash, and challah bread. Managing 30,000 or more items in a grocery store has required sophisticated information and telecommunication systems. With these systems in place, a retail store can stock shelves just in time, quickly replacing slow-moving items and tailoring stock to local demand. But the effects of these technologies go further. Joining the dots, one can attribute the growth of megastores, even the decline of brand loyalty, to the proliferation of retail information systems. In a curious reminder of the parallel between the counterculture and personal computer revolutions, society is changing in the same direction that technology is pushing business. The media, just as much as grocery stores, mirror the reversal of the melting pot syndrome in American culture. People of Chinese or Mexican descent tune into radio and TV stations in their native languages, in which newspapers are published and government documents and ballots are prepared. There are more than 60 newspapers nationwide for readers of Vietnamese origin. One of the largest distributors of ethnic newspapers, Media Masters Distribution of Queens, New York, carries more than 200 titles and makes 8,000 stops in 8 different states. A 1993 article in Advertising Age dispensed go-get'em advice to marketers about grasping the revenue opportunities that lie in pandering to the tastes of recent immigrants from Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. When these new American pioneers arrive, often with only what they can carry or wear, they will need food, clothing, household furnishings. As they attain their piece of the American dream, they will require bigger ticket items. Marketers must start from scratch in the language of each target market, work within the context of the original culture, and formulate copy and design rooted in the culture itself. And if you end up with 10 different campaigns, so be it. Often, there are not 10 different pitches for 10 different ethnic groups. Instead, marketing becomes a matter of constructing a fascinating multicultural pizza. In a Nordstrom mail-order clothing catalog, for example, a beautiful black model poses beside a yellow sports car. Beneath the size and fabric information are the words of the Chinese sage Lao Tzu. Keeping to the main road is easy, but people love to be sidetracked. A single photograph is apparently designed to appeal to women who are or would like to be young, adventurous, and sports-loving. Black women, Chinese Americans, women whose worldview has been conditioned by New Age or Eastern philosophy, or some combination of these. Nonetheless, refined and high-powered computer databases increasingly allow marketers to tailor goods, services, and promotions precisely to customers' individual preferences and requirements. The result? Customers have gone from being surprised and delighted by marketers' attempts to discover what will most please them to demanding that they do nothing less. Just as in education, minorities once thrilled to have their languages on schools' curricula at all are now insisting that their children be taught the history, literature, myths, and music of their cultures of origin. Expanding customer requirements and advancing technological means of meeting them are the driving forces of real-time management. The real-time message. Society and technology are in a continual dance, each moving and swaying in response to unanticipated moves by the other. Real-time technology swiftly embeds itself in everything, everywhere, profoundly affecting the marketplace and every business participating in it. To discover how best to use the new technological tools to cross traditional market or geographic boundaries, adapt their modus operandi, and still keep their customers happy, managers must first get acquainted with the dimensions of the new technological power and its incipient social effects. Chapter 2. The Never Satisfied Customer. Right here, right now, tailored for me, served up the way I like it. If the new consumer's expectations were spelled out on a billboard, that is how they would read. Top managers monotonously repeat, as if intoning mantras, that this is the age of customer service, or the age of the consumer. Yet few of these managers realize what they must do for that customer to earn his or her complete approval. consumer criteria for absolute satisfaction from supplier organizations, whether a company or a branch of government, have become so stringent as to seem unreal by the standards of the past. Still, some of the most unlikely institutions have gotten parts of the message ahead of the rest. They have understood the need for extraordinary flexibility and have adapted accordingly, offering consumers both choice and access. One of these is a public agency upending government's reputation for sloth and rigidity. The Department of Motor Vehicles, DMV, seeking to maximize public cooperation with the enforcement of driving laws, offers some traffic offenders, as an alternative to steep fines and a hike in their auto insurance rates, a staggering array of choices for remedial instruction, known as traffic school. These are among the options available in several states to a driver who has earned, say, one too many speeding tickets. 7 hours of daytime instruction on any day of the week, including Saturday and Sunday, or 3.5 hours each on two consecutive weekday evenings. In California, the reforming speeder can attend any of 3,000 classrooms scattered across the state, run by certified independent instructors, not government employees. The class offerings include those run by comedians who sugarcoat the predictable lessons with unpredictable wit, and those held in pizzerias, where students also get their dinner. There are the Escuela Latina de Tráfico Español, an Armenian, Persian, Spanish classes outfit, variations on, finally, a gay traffic school. Budget-conscious operations, such as the Ultimate Discount and Fun Safety Traffic School, and the catch-all establishment that advertises itself as laughs and comedy, low-cost, AM-PM, 7 days. Traffic offenders of the near future can, of course, be expected to take their punishment over the Internet, from online schools. But the DMV had a glimmer of consumer attitudes to come way back in 1986, when it handed over the job of remedial teaching to outside contractors who, being in competition with each other, have every incentive to be accommodating. The conditioning of the consumer. Choice gives the customer power. An empowered customer becomes a loyal customer by virtue of being offered products and services finely calibrated to his or her needs. That amounts to a reversal of the pattern of the past, in which consumers or users of things had to arrange their lives according to the product or service desired. People had to shop during relatively limited store hours, to buy an automobile from one of the big three, to make phone calls from fixed locations, to treat the office computer room like a temple, approaching it only through intermediary MIS priests. The personal computer remains the most stunning marker for the transition, putting personal information and network access into the hands of consumers and reinforcing consumers' growing sense of autonomy by giving them access to ever more finely tuned information on which to base buying decisions. Personal computers surpassed television set sales in revenues in 1994, outpaced VCR unit sales in 1996, and are expected to outpace TV unit sales in 1997. At the time of the PC's invention in the 1970s, the idea of buying a low-cost computer for use by one person from a specialty retail store like Circuit City seemed about as plausible as purchasing a personal aircraft or personal train from Sears Roebuck or JCPenney. Yet the conditioning of the new, empowered consumer, expecting more or less instant gratification, took place at a steady pace over many decades. Most middle-aged adults probably have some equivalent of my first glimpse of the possibilities of real time. One summer, in the early 1950s, I remember racing with my friends down to the new dry cleaner in town, in whose window flashed a big red neon sign announcing 1 hour shirt cleaning. Amazed at the efficiency, we stuck our noses against the glass to watch the astonishing maneuvers of the automatic shirt pressing machine. Like every other technology-toned consumer, I have in the intervening years come to take for granted other marvels of compressed time, direct-dial telephone and fax services for communicating almost anywhere in the world, packages delivered overnight with a bonus of being able to discover at almost any time of day the whereabouts of a parcel in transition with an 800 call to a customer service representative or with track-it-yourself software. Other time-compressed, mind-altering technologies include instantaneous worldwide news from CNN, pagers, cellular phones, mobile and wireless computing, video conferencing, and instant credit card verification with a swipe of a plastic card through a machine. The expanding expectations of choice characteristic of the new consumer are one effect of growing time pressure. To the time-conscious shopper, the most generous possible menu of purchase options offering several different price points cuts down on time spent driving around hunting and comparison shopping. Catalog-killing, price-sensitive retail chains like Walmart and warehouse clubs like Price Costco and Sam's Club serve the needs of discount-minded and low-income shoppers who want to pile up the largest number of bargains with the smallest outlay of time and effort. Pier 1 Imports actually urges shoppers to take home a piece of rattan furniture or a duri rug and try it out. It wants to encourage would-be buyers put off by not having the time to make the perfect selection and afraid of making a costly mistake. The no-questions-asked, hassle-free policies for exchanging or returning goods pioneered by stores like Nordstrom in the early 1980s are similarly motivated. Yet even these leaders in serving the new consumer's needs have little cause to relax into smug self-congratulation. Today's consumers are made more aware by modern communications. They have more choice. They are more diverse and mobile. Yet the pace of life has also made them more discontented. As a result, the American consumer's demands on the supplier appear for all the world to be increasing exponentially. The new consumer is never a satisfied consumer. A 1995 report in Fortune set out the results of a customer satisfaction survey by the University of Michigan Business School and the American Society for Quality Control. Not even Federal Express, a service star, earned a rating above 85 on a scale of 0 to 100. Although Dole Foods, purveyor of pineapple rings and other packaged consumables, did earn a top score of 90. According to the report, "I can't get no satisfaction" is the theme song of consumers who clearly believe the nation's companies are doing a lousy job of meeting their needs. Many of the losers on the list are champs in both size and reputation. Citicorp has the most advanced ATM system in the world and a global strategy as ambitious as Coca-Cola's. But consumers find banking there anything but refreshing. Nordstrom, famous for taking shoppers by the hand, is not the crowd pleaser you might think either. The department store barely broke 80. Companies with the clearest view of the new consumer's time-conscious mental landscape that are willing to adapt their modus operandi to its features will have the edge over their competition. New consumers expect from organizations, if not obeisance, then at the very least, the respect accorded an equal. Traditional business language reveals a different attitude on the part of managers, who have unthinkingly referred to marketing targets slotted into market segments of people with wants and needs assumed to be virtually identical. Consumers have been thought of in terms of classification statistics: 30 to 40 age bracket, $70,000 to $100,000 income range, 2.5 children, 2.5 cars. Or categories, such as dinks, dual income, no kids, to be manipulated into desiring the goods or services a company has to purvey. The general idea has been that if you could name it, classify it, and put it in a database, you had half the marketing problem solved. These practices are symptomatic of an obsession with measurement in the interests of control over the partitioned groups. The other half of the misguided marketing equation has dictated that dealing with individual consumers is a waste of time, and time is money. Therefore, the argument goes, it is necessary to classify consumers into large, monolithic groups and address them as if they all think and act alike. While this approach may have been expedient in the age of mass marketing, it is unlikely to survive the reign of the new consumer. A new model to fit the new consumer. The new marketing model reflects a shift from monologue to dialogue in dealings with customers. The result is a reversal of traditional consumer and producer roles, with the consumer dictating exactly how he or she would like to be served. New consumers expect to be asked about their individual preferences and treated, to the most extreme degree possible, as if those preferences are being respected. A pioneering example of the consultative approach in action is the way Philips Electronics NV, the Dutch multinational giant, developed an online product for children in the early 1990s. Phillips dispatched industrial designers, cognitive psychologists, anthropologists, and sociologists in mobile vans to communities in Italy, France, and the Netherlands. The researchers invited adults and children to brainstorm ideas for new electronics products. Instead of conducting a survey of these volunteer product designers, Phillips arranged discussions in which specialists and customers imagined new possibilities. After examining all the propositions the dialogues produced, Phillips reduced them to a short list, then chose one new interactive product. In the next stage, the researchers revisited the communities and tested the new product idea on the same children whose aid had been enlisted. The gains to be had from consulting consumers in this fashion are also demonstrated by a progressive Parisian designer of women's clothes, Emmanuel Ungaro, which licenses a line of garments to Grupo GFT, which in turn distributes them in America. The relaxed career wear bearing the Emmanuel label has been one of the few upscale collections in the business to thrive in a shrinking market, the result of an apparent decline in women's interest in high fashion clothing. Analyzing Emmanuel's success in a report on the garment industry, the New York Times said in 1996, "In fashion, manufacturers usually rely on intuition and on feedback from retailers. Instead, Emmanuel executives went right to customers, in suburbs as well as cities. We're doing a lot more analysis today than we did in the past because now the customer wants to tell the designer what she wants," said Mara Devichier, chief executive of Emmanuel. TQM, described in the introduction to this book, supplies the model. Enlightened companies invite customers to sit on advisory boards, work as partners in the refinement of specifications and testing, share benchmark data, and fine-tune the balance of supply and demand. Customers have an equal say in such areas as design and inventory management. Customers, like vendors, are treated like partners. Caution. Slow-moving vehicles ahead. In addition to such exemplary exercises in paying attention to market feedback as displayed by Phillips and Emmanuel, recent history supplies cautionary tales about companies taking the opposite tack. German automaker Porsche, for instance, lost 80% of its share of the American luxury car market to Japanese rivals in just 5 years in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Until the company ran into trouble, it refused to lower its prices, even over a period in which the dollar lost more than half its value against the mark. Both Porsche and Mercedes mistakenly believed that the appeal of brand exclusivity, and in the case of Mercedes, outstanding engineering, gave them license to price as they pleased. In 1990, I attended a J.D. Power conference, at which the keynote address was delivered by the director of marketing for Mercedes America. He boasted that while other automakers were lowering prices and so devaluing their brands, Mercedes would soon announce even more expensive models. Only a few months later, Lexus appeared on the scene, forcing Mercedes to modify its pricing and change many of its other entrenched marketing practices. But a great deal of damage had been done. Daimler-Benz lost almost $4 billion in 1995. In Porsche's case, large portions of its potential market, in which baby boomers were heavily represented, were starting families and rapidly switching from deluxe cars to minivans or buying the smart new Lexus. In addition, the government slapped on new luxury sales and gas taxes, and the economy was in a recession. Finally, with Porsche in the red and its unit sales dropping steeply, the company, like Mercedes, was sufficiently humbled to introduce new cars with more modest tags. The result was a dramatic increase in sales by 1997. Porsche's slow response was almost catastrophic, and its market share growth much slower. Brand name was no protection. Companies poorly oriented to the technology-toned consumers' changing behavioral terrain often describe their preferences in clever-sounding terms, derived from interpretations of research rather than interactive information. But the properly oriented company will set itself the goal of understanding the consumer through dialogue. It knows that customers bombarded with sales propositions that do not reflect responsiveness to their needs will increasingly react with Procrustean fury, or worse, fatal indifference. Real-time marketing permits the constant updating of information about consumers' likes and dislikes. Communications and computer technologies are now closely meshed for a constant exchange of information between distributors, retailers, and customers. Networks of this sort already exist and register rapidly changing consumer wishes. Computer-based design and manufacturing technologies are allowing companies to go even further, actually responding to those wishes with fiercely compressed product cycles and processes that incorporate more options and variety. Virtual customization through service. The fact is, now that the technological means for enormous flexibility exist, what customers expect is customization or personalization of some kind. The costs of customizing manufactured goods are falling steadily as technical refinements and managerial innovations allow flexible production plants with short runs to get closer to the low unit costs of long mass production runs. Undifferentiated manufactured goods are a steadily diminishing proportion of the output of advanced economies. Manufacturers like Levi Strauss have been lighting the way to the future. Since 1995, Levi's sales clerks have taken the measurements of women shopping for jeans and entered the numbers into computers that calculate fit. The customized jeans are sewn at a Levi's factory from a computer-generated pattern. A shoe store chain, the Custom Foot, lets women design their own shoes using a three-dimensional foot scanner. Variety, when it is broad enough, can amount to virtual customization, whether in the form of products actually sitting on retail shelves or capable of being ordered directly from the factory in a quantity of one. From the consumer's viewpoint, individual attention also amounts to virtual customization. For instance, though doctors and lawyers usually draw on the same database of knowledge, a combination of their training and experience to serve patients or clients, they apply that knowledge to specific clients in specific ways, tailored to individual needs. Every ulcer patient may be prescribed the same drug and dietary regimen, but feels as if he or she has received customized attention. Unfortunately, healthcare today is being driven by healthcare maintenance organizations, HMOs, which are degrading patient care to a one-prescription-fits-all commodity business. Consumers are becoming increasingly dissatisfied with the severe constraints on choice of physicians, cumbersome procedures for treatment approval, endless paperwork, and red tape associated with their health insurance. This approach to service will eventually fail because it violates the basic tenets of good service: interaction, a willingness to listen on the part of the service provider, customized responsiveness, and real time. Real-time technology holds the potential for restoring substance and meaning to the care in healthcare. I have been a diabetic for more than 40 years. In that span of time, I have been able to take advantage of specialized new products and medical technologies, everything from a huge and growing range of sugar-free foods to pen-sized 30-second test glucose monitors to a miniature pump that acts as an electronic pancreas supplying insulin 24 hours a day, whenever and wherever I need it. I frequently correspond via email with my doctor, Joe Prendergast. A practicing diabetologist for more than 25 years, he runs the Endocrine Metabolic Medical Center, EMMC, in Atherton, California. EMMC is a model of futuristic responsiveness in healthcare. Its operation is guided by the findings of the Diabetic Control and Complications Trial, released in 1993. This study showed that any improvement in blood glucose control reduced the risk of the various complications associated with the disease. EMMC has been conducting an experiment with CareSoft, a Silicon Valley startup, to help a subset of its patients who are having trouble maintaining their blood glucose levels within desired ranges and happen to be connected to the Internet. CareSoft has developed condition management software that enables clinic staff to assist such patients directly and proactively over the Internet in a secure environment. Data are the key to control, says Dr. Prendergast. Hence, diabetics upload data from their digital glucose monitoring devices and transmit these to the caregivers, and in return, they get recommendations and reminders from the system and instant feedback on actions to take from the caregiver. While the number of patients in this pilot project is small, preliminary results show a marked improvement in their ability to control their ailment. Patient empowerment, Dr. Prendergast believes, is probably the most philosophically exciting idea to emerge in medicine in recent years. He is trying to extend many of his findings about the effectiveness of patient power to a wider public through an organization he founded, the Pacific Medical Research Foundation. Empowerment is inextricably linked to customization. Technology-toned consumers do not merely want a customized end product. They also require some sign that a company acknowledges their individuality in almost all of its dealings with them. Personalized greetings at a hotel. Welcome back, Mr. McKenna. Thanks for staying with us. Your favorite room is available for you. Are not the half of it. I didn't realize what heights my own expectations had reached until a remark I made to a shirt salesman earned a look of horror from my wife. We sell lots of these, he said, pressing one selection on me. Now, why would I want to wear a shirt that everyone else is wearing? I snapped at him reflexively. A similarly harsh and thoroughly contemporary attitude is expressed in the New York Times report on the garment industry. Walk through the Macy's in Herald Square and experience the world of a lab mouse. Go to the contemporary department, home to shiny sheath dresses and polyester hip huggers, and realize that a coat to wear over them means a trip to another floor. Like that suit and want a nice scarf to wear with it? Trek downstairs to accessories. Over at Coats, an indifferent sales clerk, punching sales tags into the computer with all the enthusiasm of a child being immunized, should not be asked to recommend a nice pair of matching boots. They will be nowhere nearby. New customers want to feel that they have the ear of employees with the authority to make swift decisions, and increasingly, that they can reach someone who can take action. The most progressive companies allow customers access to huge corporate product-related and service databases. Today, an 800 number is even printed on a package of M&Ms and a bar of Hershey's chocolate. Some companies have already taken the step of printing the address of their website on their products, thereby providing the consumer with a gateway to galaxies of information. Information provided at a hypothetical M&M site, for instance, could range from a graphical demonstration on video of how the candy is manufactured to research information about the profiles of people who prefer eating green M&Ms to red ones. Someday, a customer with a malfunctioning electric toaster will be able to download diagrams demonstrating troubleshooting procedures, unless she decides to return or exchange the appliance and is instructed as to how to go about this painlessly over the internet or by fax. Making choice transparent. Above all, what the new consumers want is control, which chiefly means choice, even if they are not sufficiently conscious of that desire for control or choice to be capable of expressing it in a focus group. They want not only the widest array of choices, but a choice among choice-making routes. One route, for instance, would spare people the burden of choosing at all. Someone wanting this option might share the opinion of Natan Sharansky, a member of the Israeli Knesset, who after 9 years in Soviet prisons and labor camps complained of feeling lost in the West. Forced to make thousands of mundane choices about all these kinds of orange juice and cereals, he said, you lose your life in all these things. Your life becomes very shallow. Precisely that sentiment is echoed at the start of the 1996 film Trainspotting, adapted from the novel of the same name, about young heroin-addicted Scottish dropouts. A voiceover conveys the disgust the main character, Mark Renton, feels over the commercial rituals of modern society. Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a fucking big television. Choose washing machines, cars, compact disc players, and electrical tin openers. Choose fixed interest mortgage repayments. Choose a starter home. Choose leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose a three-piece suit in a range of fucking fabrics. Choose your future. Choose life. For Renton, the burden of choice is overwhelming, but there are constructive new alternatives to his drug-induced oblivion. In 1996, Rates Technology of Long Island patented a telecommunications device that can automatically select the cheapest carrier among all carriers nationwide, a total of 867 at the time, for every long-distance call placed. As soon as a phone number is punched in, the computerized processor scans all the rates of all the carriers before it makes its selection. Choice ultimately becomes transparent to the user, by virtue of either an easy-to-use interface or simple familiarity. Transparency means never having to say, damn it. When information is available at the touch of a fingertip, you have transparency. Software developed by the Colorado startup NetDelivery enables publishers of catalogs, newspapers, newsletters, and any sort of material that requires constant updating to be placed on a subscriber's computer automatically, without the user phoning, searching, clicking, or downloading. Transparency. Using such software delivers your daily financial newsletter or Land's End catalog to the desktop, always current, prices, pictures, and all. The most successful transparent human interface is the simple 12-button alphanumeric telephone keypad, which offers an almost infinite choice of communication links, not just to other owners of telephones, but to information services and directories, with the user exerting little thought or effort. For the majority who actually enjoy being offered a choice, the options provided by real-time technology will be unprecedented. The person buying a car, probably long before he or she visits a showroom to kick actual tires and take a test drive, will have done these things virtually, in some sense, through online services. The potential buyer will have browsed through comparative data and the website of, say, Consumer Reports, J.D. Power & Associates, the organization that monitors automobile trends and performance, or the Consumer Information Center. Nationally distributed car magazines have websites, as do brokers stocked with vast reservoirs of data about the relative costs and benefits of purchasing and leasing. There are internet bulletin boards linking de facto communities of owners of different makes and models of cars through which additional help and advice can be sought. A friend of mine recently purchased a new minivan after using the internet to gather data and a fax machine to send out requests for bids to dealers. She said, "It was the best and most efficient experience I have ever had of buying a car." The automobile business is being reshaped from the bottom up by the discovery of exactly this sort of potential. The consumer-driven marketplace is changing the heart and soul of this industry, Dave Power, J.D. Power & Associates founder, told me. The franchise retail system is 100 years old. Things have to change. The whole system is broken. Today's leaders, embryonic real-time organizations, are already putting in place the managerial and technical infrastructure to give consumers more information and assistance, making choice as easy as possible. They understand the edge this gives them with customers pressured on all fronts, putting in longer workdays to stay ahead of the competition or to assuage fears of downsizing, straining to find time to spend with children and equally harassed mates, longing for increasingly scarce leisure time or the time to simply get chores done. All information superhighways lead to service. Companies have long competed largely through building brand names, sowing desirable associations in the minds of potential customers with advertising slogans, discounts, and promotions. Customers have been treated like clay to be molded into loyal brand buyers. Today's enlightened company understands that lasting brand loyalty is won only one way, by dynamically serving customers. Here, dynamic means constant interaction and dialogue based on real-time information systems. Real-time service is the key to winning the hearts and minds of new consumers with their seemingly reset circadian clocks. It means being in touch all the time, creating an experience, adding information that addresses individual needs and circumstances, responding without delay, and gaining valuable feedback for new and improved offerings. Internet enthusiasts eagerly await access to devices that will allow them to be online without interruption, or in the telling phrase they use, turned on 24 hours a day. Rising businesses aiming to excel in the real-time arena have as their goal ubiquitous, non-stop, and transparent service. The new consumers hate to be kept waiting and are being conditioned in all spheres of life to become ever more impatient. The advances of technology contradict theories of human satisfaction expounded by psychoanalysis, Nobel Prize-winning novelist Nadine Gordimer observes. Apart from its purely sexual application, Sigmund Freud's deferred pleasure as a refinement of emotional experience does not compare with the immediate joy of hearing a lover's voice or getting a friend's reply to a letter at once by email. As I have noted elsewhere, what customers want most from a product is often qualitative and intangible. It is the benefit and service that is integral to the product. Service is not an event. It is the process of creating a customer environment of information, assurance, and comfort. Technology has made it possible to establish such an environment with unprecedented finesse. Many companies are using call centers, kiosks, 800 numbers, expert software, and online services to meld marketing and technology, creating a feedback loop that binds their best interests to those of their customers. This circuit has immensely enhanced sensitivity to customers' requirements and to many of their preoccupations with information and service, most of which have a time-related component. From its earliest days, the world's leading microprocessor company, Intel, discussed plans for future models of microchips with designer engineers at customer companies, such as computer makers. As Dave House, a former senior vice president at Intel, explained to me, by blending marketing and engineering, the company has been able to achieve a faster return on investment in new products. Working closely with key customers on specifications, balancing prototype products' technical capabilities against customers' receptivity to new features and requirements, Intel has developed a remarkable relationship with those customers, who are then primed to use the products they help design. As with Philips and the children who participated in its brainstorming meetings, or the customers of the fashion design firm Emmanuel, the consultees not only help to make saleable products, but become potential buyers of them. This sort of intimate dialogue between a company and its customers creates a brand loyalty immeasurably deeper than catchy jingles riding on advertising blitzes ever could. It creates a quasi-symbiotic tie. The new interactive technologies collapse the space between consumer and producer. The extraordinary attentiveness to customers' desires by companies using these tools leads their customers to expect a similar response from other companies. The galloping expectations of the technology-toned consumer can be expected to gain velocity as an electronic infrastructure allowing intensifying interactivity between producers and customers spreads wider. This is the infrastructure composed of the communication revolution's profusion of linked media. Collectively, these media represent a critical watershed. For businesses and branches of government serving the public, the important media of the past were channels for broadcast. The vital new media, by contrast, are channels of access. Access media hold the key to satisfying the consumer's runaway demands for real-time results. This is because access media help organizations serve customers better by making it possible for customers to serve themselves. Without any sense of effort, customers are satisfied by means of sophisticated, hidden, or transparent technologies about whose workings they need know nothing. The real-time message. New consumers are never satisfied consumers. Managers hoping to serve them must work to eliminate time and space constraints on service. They must push the technological bandwidth with interactive dialogue systems, equipped with advanced software interfaces, in the interest of forging more intimate ties with these consumers. Managers must exploit every available means to obtain their end, building self-satisfaction capabilities into services and products, and providing customers with access anytime, anywhere. Chapter 3. What is the message when the medium is everywhere? Media, planet-wide, are the star attraction of our time. Probably no other class of human-made phenomena so dominates our lives. Their effects on society are older than the revelations of the scribes who wrote the 2,000-year-old Dead Sea Scrolls. Media, mimic of our human expressions. As Marshall McLuhan showed us, media are extensions of ourselves. From stone to papyrus and paper to electrons, media carry what we know, how we think, what we dream of and desire, what transactions we conduct. In all their shapes and forms, from television to cyberspace, media are considered by many to be the most effective means of engaging human attention and influencing human behavior. This is truer today than ever before, even if the newest forms of media have upended the quintessential 20th century fear of media as the means for Big Brother to lash society to his ends. Instead, the most novel media could not be more profoundly democratizing in their effects, or more destructive of centralized authority, whether in government, religion, healthcare, education, or especially, as I demonstrate in this chapter, business. The new media have Big Brother on the run, a fugitive on a teeming thoroughfare of bits and bytes. Media and society are developing together, as if in lockstep. Networking, significantly, has been gaining currency as both a social and an electronic term. As media acquire bandwidth and expressive range, they exhibit more and more human-like characteristics. Conversely, they allow us to be simultaneously more individualistic and more collaborative. They are helping us to build communities of common and uncommon interests. They are reshaping the social environment. As with all technologies, the potential of new media can rarely be assessed by looking for clues in places where the conditioning of the past guides judgment and opinion. In the 1980s, when the personal computer was in its early stages of market development, a well-regarded research firm conducted a national social trend survey and predicted that the then-budding industry was in for big trouble. The survey showed that the American people did not want more technology encroaching on their lives. The conclusion drawn was that consumers would resist the notion of a personal computer, and that the industry would therefore develop slowly, if at all. My response to that conclusion was that it was dead wrong, that strangeness rapidly disappears with constant contact with the new and unfamiliar, whether in art, food, science, or technology, which is arguably least intrusive and most transforming when ubiquitous, yet hardly visible. Much of it, like the fractional horsepower motor, is hidden deep inside appliances and gadgets, with its least interesting, strictly utilitarian features on display. You might also say it is in the nature of technology to hide its complexity. In their extreme sensitivity and responsiveness to our particular needs and desires, digital technologies of the future will scarcely seem to be there at all. This genie-like transparency is one of the profound differences between future media and those of the past. New media are interactive. We have all had a foretaste of the possibilities of new media. A few years ago, an earthquake woke me at 1 o'clock in the morning in a Tokyo hotel room. As a resident of shake-prone California for decades, I automatically reached for the remote control and turned on the TV set, assuming that if I saw announcers interrupting programming and frantically running for cover, I would have to abandon my hotel. But after some channel surfing, I found all the Japanese transmissions serenely undisturbed. Then I got CNN. Within seconds, the program and process was interrupted for a report of a 4.5 tremor. Background graphics showed concentric circles, with Tokyo at the center, broadcast from a studio in Atlanta, Georgia. A CNN reporter in Tokyo, jolted awake like me, had called his news desk in Atlanta, which in turn had called the closest geological station and got the Richter reading. It had taken me a scant few seconds to confirm what I had suspected had happened miles beneath Japan with a source halfway around the world. I had had a McLuhan-esque experience of the most dramatic sort, that is, an experience of media in the broadest possible sense of the term as extensions of our ability to see and hear and touch, extensions of the human nervous system. I had taken for granted the innumerable connections involved between technological devices and organizations to tell me what I wanted to know. On the one hand, the TV set, the satellite dish and decoder, the satellite uplinks and downlinks. On the other, the hotel, the Japanese cable company, the Intelsat, and finally, CNN. All of the conduits and joints en route had been transparent to me. A transparency that partly accounts for television's subtle, quasi-subliminal conditioning of its audiences. The newest media, creations of microprocessors, bits, bytes per second, the internet, and satellite technology, are by far the most formidable agents of conditioning behind the culture of acceleration reshaping the marketplace. In addition to transparency and speed, two distinguishing features account for their extraordinary power to transform. First, interactivity. Second, entertainment, or the use of human interfaces of the most affecting sort, borrowing techniques from the entertainment business. Interactive media give consumers control and unprecedented influence over what companies offer them, as well as when and where they do so. To return for a moment to my experience of an earth tremor in Tokyo, with an interactive device of the decade ahead, my TV would also have become a direct link to Tokyo's 24-hour earthquake information center. Japan has one of the most sophisticated earthquake monitoring and research activities in the world. I might have selected